Jay McInerney has spent more than four decades chronicling ambition, desire, excess, and reinvention in New York City. Since the publication of his breakout novel, Bright Lights, Big City, in 1984, he has become one of the defining literary voices of his generation, blending sharp social observation with an insider's eye for the worlds of publishing, wealth, and culture. His new novel, See You on the Other Side, brings a long-running story to a close. The book is the fourth and final installment of McInerney's Calloway saga. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jay McInerney. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. Good to be with you again.
I look forward to our conversation. I enjoyed this book. Did you know that this would be the time that you wanted to end it, in the sense of that each novel sort of taking a decade, that this would be the end of this story?
Yeah, I pretty much started the book thinking it would be the end, because I just thought, you know, when I started this series, I didn't know it was a series when I started it, but I was writing about this glamorous young couple in their late 20s named Russell and Kareen Calloway, and they were, you know, they were good looking, they were smart and ambitious. They were the first in their group of Brown University graduates to get married. They formed a kind of social hub for their friends, and young, ambitious, and good looking. I realized at some point I didn't want to follow them into the nursery. I think that COVID obviously had brought thoughts of mortality. Yeah, I did think it was time. I really never thought there would be four books here, but now I guess it's a tetralogy.
When you look at it, that was there a point in writing that you said, okay, that I have to, that there should be some conclusion here that maybe otherwise I would have not engaged in?
You know, I think it came kind of naturally. I really didn't know, as with all my books, I didn't know what the ending was going to be when I started. And I was well into the book before I started to figure out how to end it. I thought about, you know, the obvious conclusion was to have somebody die of COVID. And I knew people who, here in New York City, who died of COVID. You know, especially in the early days, that was a distinct possibility. Kareen Calloway contracts COVID very early in the novel. In fact, very early in the, but I just thought that would be, I don't know, I just thought that would be too easy. And I was telling the story of them surviving the pandemic and eventually coming out the other side without quite knowing where I was going to end. And in fact, you know, when I started writing the book, I didn't know where this crisis was going to end, where, you know, when it was going to be over, when life in New York City was going to resume. You know, the city wasn't really the city for about a year. New York is all about people rubbing up against other people and you know, thousands of us. And it's about the, you know, the cocktail parties and the dinners and the museums and the galleries and the theater and so on. And all of that ceased to exist suddenly about around March 20th, 2020. And so it was actually a challenge trying to write the kind of social novel that I write when nothing was going on. New York was essentially just a city of architecture. I mean, it was nice to actually notice the architecture after all this time, but it was also very frustrating.
When you say social novel, talk about that a little bit of how you see that.
Well, I think that the novels that I write are mostly set in New York, and they're mostly about social interactions and about people, you know, about the work environment, about the play environment, about people having affairs, for that matter. That's kind of one of the main engines of the domestic novel is infidelity, and there's certainly some of it in this series. On both parts, really. I write about people going out and interacting with other people.
As you're reading the novel and you think of those parties, and of course, both Russell and Kareen, their daughter, is opening a restaurant. It's the opening, yep, is right there at the start of the pandemic and dealing with this. They've just come from an anniversary party, which is probably the super spreader event that came in. One of the things that struck me while I was reading it is, it wasn't that long ago, but man, I have blocked out a lot of what those times were like.
Yeah, me too. And And part of me was afraid that no one would want to revisit that time because it was pretty grim in many ways. Yeah. I found a face mask in the pocket of a sport jacket yesterday. And it brought me back in a really bad way to that time and that place. I still felt that, you know, I really had to record the impact that this event had on about in the past, like 9/11. This was an international crisis. So it didn't just affect New York, but I think in many ways, New York was probably the most affected because New York is the most densely populated city in the country. And it's the most, well, I guess it's, you know, if you think of Manhattan, it's probably the most populated small island
right.
in the country. I think it hit us particularly hard here in Manhattan. And Manhattan is really what I write about. Although, as you mentioned, Russell Green's kids figure in this novel. And like most kids, they live in Brooklyn, which is a place where the young people have been going, young writers and young chefs, which is what story is. And so I spread out a little bit, but I suppose my primary setting is still Manhattan.
Jay McInerney is our guest. The name of the new book is See You on the Other Side. Tell us about the creation of this couple of Russell and Corinne. They, when you originally started of what you wanted to explore in this young relationship.
Well, when I published my first novel, Bright Lights, Big City, my life was kind of turned upside down, mostly in a good way. But I became a public figure, especially here in New York, and my life was turned upside down. I got a divorce during this time, and I traveled the world, and I met everybody I ever wanted to meet, and I realized that my life had ceased to be very representative. You know, I wasn't writing about me was no longer probably the way to go. And I felt like I was interested in writing about people who Russell is essentially, he would have been me if that had not happened to me. In other words, if I hadn't become a novelist, if I hadn't written a novel, I would have almost certainly been an editor. So Russell is kind of what Philip Roth calls my counter life, you know, the life that I might have lived. If I had stayed married, if I hadn't published a novel, I almost certainly would have been an editor. So it kind of started out as an alternate version of myself. And Corinne is honestly kind of, you know, the idealized, at the time, I felt she was sort of the idealized female companion. And I decided, you know, I wanted to explore a marriage that survives the vicissitudes of life of Manhattan. You know, I said somewhere that this invention of the channel changer is similar to monogamy, what monogamy is to Manhattan, which is to say it's tough to stay married in New York, but it's something that they do. And, you know, I was interested in writing about that kind of marriage.
Both of, and we learn in this novel, I mean, these are both people who have strayed at certain points in the marriage, and yet there is something essential that keeps them together and brings them back and keeps them together as a unit. That's almost a necessity.
Yeah, and I think in the end, in this book, you know, it's clear that they love each other and that, you know, their marriage is, I don't want to say ideal because it has a lot of cracks and flaws, but ideal in the sense that it survived the storm all the way through.
When you have the characters, and it's some of the other characters who come into their lives and are that represent various personalities in a city environment of the people who are pushing to do this or pushing to do that or have done this or got away with this or didn't get away with this. And it's sort of all here on display, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think their friends are, you know, also smart, ambitious city dwellers navigating careers and marriages in Manhattan. And, you know, these basically are the people I live among. This is my tribe.
And that is a, for you at this stage of your life, an enjoyable place to be.
Yeah. I mean, I have so much history here, and you know, I came to the city when I was in my early 20s, and I just have an awful lot of history. I have an awful lot of friends, acquaintances, associates, and I've watched the city grow and change. When I first arrived here, it was kind of a scary place. You know, there was a lot of crime. The city was only a year and a half away from its bankruptcy crisis. There was some question about whether it was going to continue to go downhill or whether it was going to rise from its own ashes. And in 1979, that wasn't clear. Obviously, it was going through a renaissance, and you know, the combination of Wall Street money and the reversal of what we call white flight. A lot of middle class people were leaving the city in the 70s, and they started coming back in the 80s. Obviously, in many ways, this was a good thing. Although, from the point of view of young artists and writers and so on, gentrification had its downsides because the city became more expensive. When I came here, it was not very expensive, and it was easy for us to populate these relatively marginal neighborhoods because they were considered undesirable. I mean, I still love the city, but sometimes I wish it were a little grittier.
And what does that give it? What do you think you're missing as a result of it not being grittier?
Well, it's a good question. Graffiti, for one thing. You know, it's funny when my you know, once in a while we go somewhere where there's some graffiti on the buildings, you know, and my wife goes, "Oh dear, this must be a bad neighborhood." But to me, it's a nice sort of reminder of the New York that I first lived in, when almost everything was covered in graffiti. The subway cars, in particular, were just, you know, they were painted sort of. Virtually every inch was covered with graffiti, and I don't know. I mean, there was a kind of youthful energy in New York, which is not quite as much here as it used to be. I mean, you know, as I said, artists and writers used to be able to come and live here and work here, and it's harder for them now because there's so much more money than there used to be. There's a lot of Wall Street money. And while I realize that Wall Street money is important for keeping the city afloat and lubricated, you know, I sort of miss the idea that middle-class people can make a life here.
Jay McInerney is our guest. The name of the new novel, See You on the Other Side. It is published by Knopf. You talk about how Bright Lights, Big City really changed your life, and just everything sort of exploded after that. Published in 1984. And as you said, writing a lot about what you knew at that point of being young and working at the New Yorker and as a fact checker, and how important that was to the magazine, and what happened when things went wrong. What was your initial, I guess, understanding or thought of what that novel could be to the literary world when it initially went out?
Well, honestly, my biggest hope for that novel was that it would get a few good reviews and I would be able to get a teaching job out of it. Because by that time I'd been fired from the New Yorker for being a bad fact checker. And it seemed to me that, you know, either publishing or teaching were the ways to go. And I was just hoping to have a credential, really, with Bright Lights, Big City. I mean, there were times when I was writing Bright Lights when I was very excited, and I thought, you know, this is something a little bit new under the sun. But at the same time, I had been working in publishing. I'd been working as a reader of the Slush Pile at Random House, and I had watched, you know, I had watched young writers publishing novels which basically just disappeared into the void, more or less. And so I had fairly realistic I had a fairly realistic sense of the literary marketplace, and I didn't have any reason to think that I was going to be the exception to the rule. As it turns out, I guess I was, and I'm very grateful for that.
This many years later, do you know what happened? Do you know what it is that struck a chord with readers?
Well, I don't know. I think I was writing about a scene that just hadn't really been written about, and certainly in literary novels, the sort of downtown, the nightclubs and the drug scene, and I think that a lot of people were sort of fascinated and horrified by that. And also, I think, as I say, New York was really starting to undergo a renaissance, and this novel kind of became part of it, and part of people's increasing interest in life in New York, life in Manhattan. It was kind of part and parcel of that revival, as it were. No, I still think it's well written, and I'm really pleased with it. But I can't really tell you why it was so successful.
I mean, it certainly seems that it was. I mean, I remember reading it when it came out and thinking to myself, oh, okay, this is something. And there was an excitement to it and very much talked about. And I was in college and it was like, this is amazing. And so it was I always thought of it as something that, as you say, that caught a scene that perhaps had not been written about. And what struck me when you answered the question initially of saying for a literary novel, and I think that was what was also excited about it, is it was so well written, and it was telling us about people that we probably shouldn't trust, and yet we were very interested in as to what was happening in their lives.
Well, I remember, I mean, one of the things that was a little unusual about the book at the time, and now it's just it's a given, but I remember one reviewer complaining that I was mixing allusions to Shakespeare with allusions to the Talking Heads, and somehow feeling that, you know, suggesting that this wasn't done. And but I think that was something that made the book a little more popular.
Isn't that always the way? Just David Byrne and Shakespeare.
Yes.
I think too. Then after that, you also wrote the screenplay to the movie. But even in that 4 years from the time the book came out to the time the movie came out, I mean, things had changed. Like the novel itself had changed how people looked at that time and where we were in the mid-80s.
Well, yeah, I think the passage of 3.5-4 years was really kind of noticeable for several reasons. And one was that early 1984, we hadn't heard of AIDS. We hadn't seen so many casualties of the sort of the high life and drugs and cocaine. Nancy Reagan hadn't started her Just Say No campaign. And so I think by the time the movie finally got made, there was a feeling on the part of the producers that they didn't want to over-glamorize this character in this life. And, you know, that's not a problem that I had writing the book. I didn't have this sense of, ooh, I have to be careful not to make cocaine seem glamorous. I mean, it was just there. And I was just writing about something that I observed and something I participated in. The movie's darker than I really wish it were, you know?
And when you say darker, I mean, it was also, I think, a lot of that had to do with the perspective, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also, honestly, I think the novel was groundbreaking. I think the movie was not. And I did write the screenplay, and I'm not sure I should have, because it was very faithful to the book, but the book found a new way of telling a story. You know, the second person narrative was very unusual, and the screenplay did not find that new way of telling a story. You know, I think of The Graduate as being, you know, that The Graduate is kind of what I wanted the movie to be,
Right.
You know, with all those Mike Nichols. But I don't know. The director, James Bridges, of Bright Lights, Big City, I don't think he really fully grasped this milieu. I mean, he made some good movies, but, you know, he wasn't a New Yorker. He wasn't young. And he was quite knew what to do with the material, frankly.
And Michael J. Fox, who played the central character, of course, he got great reviews for that portrayal, and it was different. And it was also different for him. This certainly wasn't Back to the Future.
No, nor Family Ties, which is
right.
He's coming off this wildly popular television show where he played this sort of straight-laced Republican kid. And suddenly, you know, he's got a straw in his nose. And I think some of his fans were a little disconcerted by that. And some of my fans thought that he was the wrong person for the part. I mean, we went through a lot of – originally Tom Cruise was going to play the part. And finally, there was such a long delay that he went on to do Top Gun, which, you know, so, I don't know. He certainly would have been an interesting choice.
In See You on the Other Side with Russell and Corinne, but especially Russell, this is a character, as you say, who's lived the life that you would have lived perhaps if you had not had that success. Although this is still a character who has gone through a lot when it comes to drugs and the scene that they lived through in the 80s and 90s. And
yeah.
It doesn't seem, and if I'm reading this correctly, let me know if I'm wrong here, but you don't seem to portray it as something that that many people say of, I survived the 80s, or I survived the early 90s, or I survived this time. You don't seem to have that thought process ingrained in it.
I think certainly Russell, feels like that was a very exciting time, you know, when he was young and going to the Odeon, doing drugs in a stall beside Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I think that they, you know, that like most of us, they feel pretty good about their youth. And I think being young in the 80s was particularly exciting. And I'm always intrigued by the number of young people who specifically are interested in the 80s and the time period that I wrote about in Bright Lights, Big City. There's definitely nostalgia for that analog colorful world of big hair and big shoulder pads.
I flinch in asking this question, but so much was written about within film, the Brat Pack, and then it became the literary Brat Pack with you and Tamma Janowitz and Bret Easton Ellis and so forth. Is that real?
Was it
something that really existed, or was that hype?
I was kind of a media construct. You know, it's always easier. It's always easier for journalists to write about groups rather than
individuals,
and to find similarities rather than differences. And so, you know, I think of Bret Easton Ellis and Tamma Janowitz as being stylistically quite different from me. However, there was a period when we all were hanging out in Lower Manhattan and going to some of the same parties and some of the same nightclubs, and we were photographed a lot doing that. And so, you know, partly real, partly made up, I would say.
But you're also going through the success at the same time, which is interesting.
Well, yeah, although I like to point out I was the first by...
Yes. By how long?
Well, I mean, so Bright Lights is published in September 84, and I think Brett published Less Than Zero in April or May of 85.
Yeah.
Not sure, but Tamma's first book was not as successful as Slaves of Manhattan, which I think that was 85. Yeah, that was 85 as well, because I reviewed it for the New York Times. So that would have come after Bright Lights. Yeah, so I like to say, you know, I was the first. There certainly wasn't a Brat Pack when I published Bright Lights, Big City.
And obviously that comes in retrospect, because as yeah. at the time, it's just coming out and you're all doing your thing, and it's looking back to realize of what impact it had.
Yeah. But yeah, we were all, I was good friends with Brett, and I remain friends with him. Although he's moved back to Los Angeles. So I don't see him as much as I used to, but we used to have dinner every Friday night when we were both in the city. It was just a routine. And you know, he read some of my early drafts. I read some of his. But as I say, I think he's a very stylist. And I mean, he writes from a much more clinical point of view than I do. I'm more of a romantic, I think.
Mm. Yes. I mean, he has a spareness there, yeah. Very much so. Do you see yourself writing another novel without these characters?
Yeah, definitely. And I am kind of glad to be, you know, time to move on, time to do something new. So I'm pleased with the tetralogy, and but also glad to start from scratch again. I have a memoir that I've written, which may or may not be published next. And I have a novel in mind, which I'm going to sit down to soon. I've been sort of taken up with promoting this book for the last month or two. But I'm looking forward to my next novel, whatever it might be.
Well, in the meantime, there is this new novel. It is See You on the Other Side. It is published by Knopf. Hey, McInerney, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I thank you so much for taking the time out. Congratulations on the new novel, and thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Again, the name of the new book is See You on the Other Side by Jay McInerney, published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.